So I'd like to go ahead and introduce our panel briefly, just say who they are. Their bios are in the materials, and perhaps they don't really need an introduction for most of you. Moderating today is Jacqueline Charlesworth, who's the General Counsel and Associate Register of Copyrights at the U.S. Copyright Office. Moving down the line, Kenneth Steinthal, who is a partner at King & Spalding. Next is Richard Reamer, who is Vice President of Legal Services, Senior Vice President of Legal Services at ASCAP. Sorry, Richard. And Stu Rosen, who is the Senior Vice President and General Counsel of BMI. So obviously very knowledgeable panel, and I will let Jacqueline take it away.
Thank you for inviting me. It's always a pleasure to be here in my home base in New York, and to see all these familiar faces. I'm sure a lot of you have a great deal of familiarity with the consent decrees, but I thought before we get to the really good stuff with my esteemed panelists here, I would just do a very brief run through to give you sort of the basic history of the decrees and kind of where we are with them today, and then they're going to take it away. And I think my main job is here to sort of keep the peace and a civil discussion. I have no doubt that it will be, Ken, because I'm next to Ken and I can, you know, kick him if necessary. All right. So just really briefly, this is just a brief history. In 1897, we have a public performance right for musical works. 1914, ASCAP is established, so they're now a little over 100 years old to collect on that right. BMI follows in 1939. In 1941, the Department of Justice was concerned about anti-competitive practices and filed suit against ASCAP and BMI. And this is the origin of the decrees we're talking about today. Basically, the concerns were, at the time, the groups required exclusive rights for members and offered only blanket licenses. And those actions were settled by the first versions of the consent decrees. So those decrees have been in effect since 1941. And interestingly, until recently, at least for the ASCAP decree, like the docket went all the way back to 1941. I think Judge Coate changed that. But it was really difficult even to, you know, sometimes find what you were looking for. There were some very important decisions, and in fact, I'm privileged to be up here with Richard Reamer. Was just telling me about his, he was involved in some of these, but not Alden Rochelle.
He not Alden. Yeah. That's good. Close. Close. No cigar.
However, I think, Alden Rochelle, just very quickly, was a private suit brought by movie theater owners and resulted in an injunction against ASCAP, which, again, this rule kind of continues to today, banning them from licensing movie theaters. So that's outside of the scope of what ASCAP handles today. Then we had a very important case, the CBS case, which went to the Supreme Court, which really was about whether the blanket licensing was an anti-competitive practice. And the Supreme Court, in a nutshell, said, look, it's not per se illegal. You have to evaluate this under a rule of reason test. You have to sort of balance the equities here and see whether the good outweighs the bad. And that, so when you're thinking about antitrust policy today and how it applies under the consent decrees, it's the rule of reason test, which says in some situations, collective licensing and people combining together to license on a blanket basis can be okay. And you have to sort of look at it on its merits. And then shortly after that, a few years after that, another case, similar case challenging the blanket licenses brought by local broadcasters. And once again, the blanket licensing system is upheld, basically the court finding that there were realistic alternatives to the blanket license for someone who wanted to get a license directly and so forth, that those presented realistic alternatives to taking the blanket, and that, therefore, the license was acceptable under the rule of reason test. So here we have, just as I mentioned, the two decrees, both date back to 1941. ASCAP decree last amended in 2001 before, I think, the introduction of the iPod, so it's sort of at the beginning of the digital era, but certainly not the digital era as we now know it. BMI, last amended in 1994, certainly before the real dawn of the digital era. And in both cases, the oversight of the decrees is entrusted to federal courts here in New York. Judge Cote is the judge who oversees the ASCAP decree, and Judge Stanton, the BMI decree. The PROs, these are sort of the key elements. The decrees are not exactly the same, but they share some key elements. Non-exclusive rights, so the publisher retains the right to license directly. A licensee can basically begin performing musical works merely upon filing an application, and then the rates are set later, which I think you may hear more about that today. There have to be some alternatives to the blanket license, per program licenses, per segment licenses, or licenses that are adjustable if there is some direct activity. If you're unable to agree on a rate with the licensee, you go to your rate court, and there's a trial, and we're definitely going to hear about the Pandora litigation and the two trials that have taken place in that area today. The BMI and ASCAP both have to accept any member who meets certain minimum criteria. And ASCAP, in their decree, can't license mechanical rights. BMI's decree doesn't actually say that, but in practice that's been followed by BMI. I think I'm going to not get into too much of this, but basically the Pandora litigation, you'll hear about this. The two rate courts ruled that large publishers who wanted to withdraw certain rights, their digital rights, couldn't do that selectively. They had to be either all in or all out. That kind of spawned, I think that's probably a lot of the reason we're sitting here today, was those rulings and the significance for publishers who want to operate perhaps more in the free market. Those decisions were followed by the rate setting trial and decision by Judge Cote that came out in 2014, and we just completed a trial with no decision yet with BMI in their rate court with Pandora. Meanwhile, I think, again, growing out of the sort of discussion about Pandora and the concerns of some of the publishers, the DOJ, and also just more general attention to our music licensing system, including a Copyright Office study, the DOJ opened a review of the consent decrees. And basically, ASCAP and BMI are seeking some modifications. They want the ability to be able to partially withdraw rights so that you don't have to commit all of your rights to either ASCAP or BMI. They want to replace the federal court rate setting process with an arbitration process, and they want the ability to bundle rights, license beyond the performance right. And we, the Copyright Office, in February, sort of were looking at a broader set of issues, but also looked at the consent decrees and made some recommendations in a report that we issued in February, which basically supported the right of having more, some partial withdrawal of rights, relaxing some of the government oversight, separating the antitrust oversight and the rate setting oversight. So our suggestion was to move any rate setting to the Copyright Royalty Board and separate that from sort of the concerns about any potential anti-competitive conduct, which will remain with the DOJ and federal courts. Made some other recommendations about songwriters being directly paid, requiring immediate payment from licensees, and last but not least, figuring out a way to establish a central and authoritative music database. So we've weighed in on this and on a broader set of music licensing issues, so that's also in the air in Washington as people await the DOJ decisions or recommendations. And with that, I'm going to turn it over to my panelists. I thought we'd start with sort of a lightning round on Pandora. And I'm going to give, we'll start with Ken. We'll give him 5 minutes since it's sort of two against one, your colleagues there can have, 2.5 minutes each. Is that fair? Okay, you guys can do it.
We can't even win here.
I'm delighted to be here. There are a lot of familiar faces in this audience. Unfortunately, 99% of them are on the other side. Some go way back. I see Helene here going back to the Buffalo Broadcasting case witnesses. I mean, there's a lot of history in this room that I respect. And I hope you'll respect the positions that we've articulated on behalf of our clients. And I'm going to give the Pandora case perspective from the licensee community side. Obviously, you'll hear from others, and most of you in the room have your perspectives. And the Pandora litigations were obviously quite important, and the twin issues involved are matters of decree interpretation and rate. And I think most of the attention that everybody's been giving to it has been about the decree interpretation issues regarding partial withdrawals. And I want, and here's where I'm probably going to go out there on a limb a little bit on my side. I find this whole subject matter to be ironic. The publishers claim that they need to partially withdraw. Why? Because they want to have a free market, because they feel that deals done under consent decree structure where ASCAP and BMI can't say no, and that a rate is going to be set with judicial oversight, don't give publishers the ability to extract the full value of their works in a, quote, free market. And we're going to come to some questions later about what kind of market might exist if everybody was withdrawn. But the point is, that position and the motivation that we've heard in all the decisions and in all the depositions, the other side of that, the reason that they wanted to partially withdraw was why? Because of the disparity. How many times have we heard about the disparity between sound recording performance royalties and composition performance royalties that digital services pay? Like Pandora, where it's public, that they pay 50% of their revenues for sound recording performances under the Section 114 license, and historically, before these litigations, only about 4% of their revenues for composition performances. What I want to do now is talk about how ironic these two positions are in light of the following. First of all, let's remember Section 114I. Section 114I is the provision in the copyright law lobbied for and obtained by the publishers and the performing rights organizations that says you cannot make reference to and use sound recording performance royalty rates in ASCAP BMI rate proceedings. Why? Because the publishers and PROs were convinced that since historically nothing was paid for sound recording performances on terrestrial, virtually nothing was going to be paid for digital. And so they wanted to make sure that the results of CRB proceedings would never be used in ASCAP BMI proceedings. Irony number one. Irony number two. The claim, as I said earlier, is this disparity, which has driven the publishers to withdraw, where did it come from? Well, number one, it came from a CRB rate setting. It came from a compulsory license with rate setting. So much for the notion that the reason for depressed publishing rates is because you can't get fair rates from a compulsory license rate setting environment. Of course you can. That's exactly where the CRB rates for sound recordings came from. And also ironic, where did this disparity come from? Why does it exist? It exists because in the very first copyright royalty case on sound recording side, and I see some of you in this room that were involved in what was then called a CARP, Copyright Arbitration Royalty Panel case, we, on behalf of the licensees, argued, hey, we should pay for sound recordings exactly what we pay for composition performances. And it was the sound recording owners who argued, totally different industry. Publishing, they're just cash cows, they do nothing, they don't invest. And you had representatives of the affiliated companies of those very publishers testify that they should get much more than the composition performance right. And you know what? They won that issue. And that disparity exists today. And I loved it when Zach Horowitz testified in the first Pandora case, because he was the poster child to make this argument. He authored the position in the original CARP, and then he moved over to the publishing side of Universal and said, we need to make up for this disparity. This disparity, Zach, that you created. So when you talk about all the reasons why the partial withdrawals have been requested, you've got to look at these ironies. And the last of the ironies is we never hear the publishers complain about a little tiny disparity between sound recording performances and publishing performances in the very mature industry of over-the-air radio, where publishers get hundreds of millions of dollars a year, and sound recording companies get zero. Where are they when that disparity is out there? So there are a lot of ironies in the positions that have been articulated. Now, ultimately what happened, in a nutshell, there's provisions in the ASCAP and BMI decrees that basically say licensees have the right to a license to all the works in the repertory of ASCAP and BMI upon request. The partial withdrawal scheme is something that would leave the compositions of the withdrawing publishers within the repertoires of ASCAP and BMI for all purposes other than digital. And so the judges, both Judge Cote and Judge Stanton, construed the decrees as basically saying, look, on request, you've got to give a license to all the works in your repertoire. You can't selectively allow publishers to pull out some works and license all their works for other means. Now, later we're going to talk about all in versus all out. Those decisions don't mean that publishers can't fully withdraw, but the bottom line is you've got to choose to be all in or all out, and that's what these decisions say. Judge Stanton reached a different decision only on the effect of partial withdrawals. Judge Cote found that the partial withdrawals were ineffective as a matter of law because they violated the decree, and therefore all the publishers were deemed back in ASCAP. Judge Stanton found that the partial withdrawals effectively made the publishers all out, and therefore there was a gap where there was a period of time where publishers who had withdrawn, like Sony, had to make a determination about whether to go back in, and publishers who had given notice to BMI, like Universal, that they were going to withdraw, had to make a determination as to whether they would be all in or all out. And the differences in rate in the cases, and obviously there's not enough time to really talk about it, but the key issues on rate were that all these cases turn on benchmarks. What's the right benchmark for a given licensee? And Pandora's position was that its historic licenses were the best benchmark with ASCAP and BMI, and that the radio rates were good benchmarks because Pandora is a non-interactive radio service, and many of the entities that operate terrestrial radio also operate, like iHeartMedia, internet radio services that pay at the terrestrial radio rate of 1.7. So Pandora has been arguing the rate should be between 1.7 and 1.85. Judge Cote set it at 1.85. The benchmarks that the PROs have been arguing have been based on the rates that each of Sony and Universal obtained during the windows of their partial withdrawals, if you will. In the first round against ASCAP, Sony and Universal had withdrawn before the decision of Judge Cote that the publishers were all back in. And the issues there are really, a market rate. Nobody disputes that the Sony and Universal rates with Pandora were market rates. The question is it a competitive market rate?
Okay, Ken, sharing a microphone with Ken, not a good plan, because I have to, actually take it away from him. No, thank you. I think, now that was good. I mean, and so you guys, I do want to try and get through a lot of material. So if you can respond a little bit on the points and the
sure.
maybe some of the ironies that Ken raised and the other issues, that would be great.
On the irony point, I don't necessarily disagree with the historical context, but let's take another step back. When the 114i provision was put into the copyright law, we were dealing essentially with a different industry, music industry, than we're dealing with today. As I'm sure most of you know, this year and last year, introduced in Congress, we've had the Songwriter Equity Act, which would redress this disparity. The problem that the publishers perceived, on behalf of the writers, of course, is that with the change in the industry, with the radical reduction in the recording aspect of the industry, you no longer have that stream of income. And the only way to make it up is on the performing rights side. So that, to me, is the reason why you had this publisher move to withdraw their catalogs, at least for the new media space. On the in or out concept, at least from ASCAP's point of view, Even Judge Coate, we think, could make a mistake in reading the language of the decree. I think, as everyone here knows, copyright law gives exclusive rights. When members join ASCAP, they give us non-exclusive rights. They retain the right to license on a direct basis. And many of you know, of course, that there has been direct licensing now for many years. Jacqueline mentioned the Buffalo Broadcasting case. As a result of that case, many, many ASCAP members have licensed local television stations, resulting in reduced license fees. So we don't have a problem with direct licensing, and our publishers want the ability to do that, particularly, again, in the new media space. The problem we see with Judge Coate's decision, and one of the grounds for our appeal, obviously, before the Second Circuit, is that in reading the ASCAP decree, Judge Coate did not give any effect to the possibility of members restricting their licensing of particular works if they felt that was appropriate. And again, the consent decree, as everyone I think knows, as Jacqueline mentioned, as a result of the Alden Rochelle case, prohibits ASCAP's members from licensing movie theaters. So you have very specific examples in the decree in which members are permitted to withhold their rights from specific users. On benchmarks, quite simply, we think Judge Coate erred in considering all of the benchmarks. She rejected some of them. I think if she had allowed us, for example, the opportunity to take discovery on the eve of trial with regard to agreements that had been reached between the Sony and Universal BMI catalogs and Pandora, we would have had additional evidence to demonstrate that the rates should have been higher. And the point we made in the argument to the Second Circuit, I think, is a very persuasive one. None of the agreements, none of the licenses with the publishers that were entered into after the EMI Pandora agreement in 2011 and 12, were at any rates other than higher than the rate that Judge Coate fixed. So we think there are very good reasons why she erred and the case should go back for additional findings on an appropriate rate.
Okay, Stuart, do you have anything you want to throw in from the BMI perspective?
Just a little bit. Can you hear me back there? Thank you. On Section 114, I mean, Kenny's absolutely right. It was the publishers, it was the PROs that sought Section 114I. That said, I'm not sure that legislation, I think legislation has to rise above a theme of you made your bed, now lie in it. I think what we're looking to do right now is simply get rid of an evidentiary obstacle. When the judge looks at sound recording rates, he may be or she may be completely unmoved by them. The rate needle might not move at all, but we think it's only fair and appropriate that a court that's looking at setting rates has a fuller picture of the music industry. In terms of Judge Stanton's all-in, all-out decision, I think the real lasting effect of that is ultimately going to be that it accelerated the discussion on rate on consent decree reform, and I think that's nothing but a good thing. And I hope we can get into the details of that as we move along. As long as we're trafficking in irony here, the only irony that I would mention is the irony that is. That the large music user groups for decades have been saying that the PROs are monopolies that extract monopolistic prices, and if only we had the opportunity to negotiate one-on-one with publishers, the world would be a better place. And so you would think that there'd be nothing but excitement on the user side of the table when we are proposing a form of rights withdrawal with appropriate protections. And in fact, what you see is a complete opposition to that. So it's one thing to point a finger at the PROs. It's another thing when you have an opportunity to negotiate in the free marketplace to try to avoid that at all costs.
Okay, well, thank you. And so one of the sort of pieces of this conversation that sort of came up shortly after the decisions disallowing partial withdrawal has been a couple of the large publishers, as we probably most of you have heard, have essentially said, well, you know, if we're not allowed that right, then we may totally withdraw from the PROs and administer our performance rights, all of them directly. So the question for the table, is this realistic? And what would the world look like if that came to pass? If one or more of the, you know, the big three publishers, or and perhaps other publishers, withdrew their rights entirely from ASCAP and/or BMI? Ken?
Well, we have a little bit of experience with that already, insofar as after Judge Stanton's decision and after delaying at least several weeks before making a final decision as to whether they were going to come back into BMI or not, each of the major publishers, Sony and Universal, and ultimately BMG, which had withdrawn their rights or said that they were going to withdraw permanently, went back in. So I think, and all of the publishers are still in ASCAP. They've always had the right to fully withdraw. So it may be that this tells us something, that they don't want to be fully withdrawn. They would rather have the benefit of collective licensing for virtually all of the marketplaces that ASCAP and BMI license, while wanting to have the ability to not be subject to rate court oversight and compulsory licensing for just limited markets where they feel they have the ability to do to directly license and administer those licenses. I don't think they want to be fully out, and, you know, time will tell.
I can only tell you what the publishers are telling us, and I think, as everyone knows, they sit on our board of directors, and at least...
For now.
And at least three of them have said that they're intent on getting out entirely if, in the first instance, at least, the Justice Department doesn't agree to partial withdrawals. Now, that, of course, might serve the interests of those who withdraw, but I think ultimately what it does is to put at great disadvantage the independent publishers, songwriters, and ultimately licensees. I don't know that Ken wants to be negotiating with 5, 10, 50, 100 different publishers. Maybe his clients want him to do that. Might serve well.
If I can get global rights in one deal from Sony, Universal, and Warner, I've got 70-some-odd% of the world's music globally in three deals. So this world that we're in is changing. And the especially in digital, where your marketplace is truly global, don't assume that our clients aren't interested in direct licensing. We're interested in transparency so that we know who owns what rights, so that if somebody wants to charge too much, we can steer away from the owners of those rights and just use the music where the price is something that we're willing to pay. So that's what a price competitive market is supposed to be. Lacking transparency, you can't really do that. You have to take broad-based licenses because you don't know enough. But I wouldn't assume that our clients, especially in digital, fear a world of publisher licensing without PROs. Very different in audiovisual, where music is in the can, and it's a whole separate set of circumstances, which we'll end up talking about a little bit later.
Yeah, if you can, like, talk, I mean, a lot, one of the questions that comes up a lot in this conversation is, like, what about bars and restaurants? What about all the, I mean, we're you know, it's not all, a total withdrawal would actually impact far more than digital services. So I think, you know, how would publishers, as a practical matter, be able to administer that? I don't know if you guys have any thoughts on that when you're, or Stu, when you're answering the question.
I mean, I'll start with that. I think it's a practical problem that's solvable. I wouldn't, if somebody's rooting for the publishers to stay in to the PROs solely based on the faith that only we can do that kind of licensing, I'd question that. I think there are a lot of folks out there who would love the opportunity to get the business. I think we're better at it. I think we've been doing it for a very long time, and if we can't do it better than everybody else, we have a big problem. But I think that's not going to be the obstacle to rights to termination. Let's talk about termination. And so I do think it's entirely possible. It's a real possibility that at least one publisher is going to go out there and see what it's like, and that's going to change a lot of things. It's certainly, if you're a, let's remember that the publisher who leaves, for every publisher who leaves, is about 10,000 other publishers who will remain affiliated at BMI. They're going to want the value, and ASCAP. They're going to want the value of what the PROs bring. I think the issue is really one of big versus small. If you have small independent publishers that are taking advantage of the benefits of the PROs, how do you keep independent publishers independent? Well, I think the way you do that is you give PROs the tools to allow the small publishers to compete on an even playing field with the big guys. And so that's why things like, for example, bundling rights is important. In the digital space, bundling rights is a compelling need. We should be able to do that on a voluntary basis. Just like the publishers out there. Songwriters, I think songwriters understandably are concerned about the changes that are going to happen if there's a publisher termination, or a withdrawal for that matter. But songwriters, again, have, certainly we're in the era of rights recapture, and so songwriters have their own leverage, and we'll see how that plays out. Music users, I think music users, as Ken says, better get used to writing a couple of extra checks. I think the era of making a deal with two or three organizations, I think that's going to be over. And so in that era, music users may argue that the performing rights license value diminishes in that kind of environment, and I'd argue the opposite. I'd argue that when you have a source of aggregated content, in an era of splintered rights, I think it makes us at least as valuable as we've always been, and perhaps more so.
Okay, I'm gonna,
can I just very briefly respond to what Ken said about global licensing? That works perhaps for a Pandora or a Spotify or one of the other major new media services. But what about other? What about the smaller users? And responding to what Jacqueline's question addressed, there's no guarantee that the performing rights organizations, when faced with withdrawals by major publishers, are yet going to be willing to undertake the license of smaller users. So again, you have a situation where others may be left in the lurch as a result of what goes on in the new media space.
Okay. Stuart briefly mentioned some of the songwriters, and I kind of wish we had a songwriter up here today. I feel like we need an empty chair for Elijah the songwriter. What would Elijah be saying to all this? Richard, I know you have songwriters on your board,
right.
I'm sure you've heard plenty, and whatever you can share with us, I can tell you from our study, but the Copyright Office, there's a great deal of concern about transparency issues in a world where the writer's share potentially isn't being paid through the PRO. There's also been issues raised about the legal authority of publishers to withdraw rights, under contracts that say the writer's share shall be paid through the PRO. So if you can give us some thoughts and impressions on that, speaking on behalf of the songwriters as much as you can. Thank
yes.
you.
Thanks. Thank you. Yes, that is a terrific concern on the part of songwriters. Indeed, there have been efforts publicly on behalf of some of the songwriter organizations to engage in dialogue with the major publishers over these very issues. Certainly in terms of split works that are the result of joint creation, joint works, license agreements that are out there now, the publisher songwriter agreements typically from years ago granted rights to the publisher, but the songwriter retained the right to be paid through a performing rights organization. And even in some of the agreements, the publishers agreed that it would be the songwriter who determined where the publisher's performing rights would lie. So you have all of these competing concerns. On behalf of the songwriters, of course, one of their principal concerns as well is the transparency issue. What will they know about the deals that are being done directly between the publishers and the users? And one frequently hears cited the example of the DMX direct license situation, where, as a matter of public record, it's known that Sony Music was able to get a $2.7 million advance from DMX. That was used to set the benchmark rate for other publishers who licensed directly and, of course, ultimately for the performing rights organizations as a result of the BMI and ASCAP rate decisions involving DMX. And the publishers are very much, I'm sorry, the songwriters are very much concerned that they didn't see any of that advance money. They also know that there's the possibility of deals being struck between publishers and music services, the digital services, that results in equity for the publishers, and again, something that the songwriters don't see. So we have these kinds of issues. They're live issues. And one of the ironies, again, that we talk about here is the fact that the music publishers certainly want partial withdrawal of rights, but they haven't yet come to the point of agreeing, according to the songwriters, on how transparent they will be in terms of the deals that would be made. This is as well a source of concern to the Department of Justice, as we've been hearing over the course of the last year.
Okay, thank you. Now I'm going to turn to sort of a unsexy topic, data, metadata. In the Pandora decision, Judge Coate was very critical, I think, of sort of a couple of the publishers withhold, were her perception that they withheld data about the songs they owned and that it created a difficulty and sort of changed the leverage they had with respect to Pandora. I know that the data issue has come up in the DOJ process, I'm sure, and the Copyright Office obviously has a point of view on this and thinks we think that, you know, we really need much more authoritative data out there in the world. But I was just wondering if maybe starting with Ken, you know, you could share your thoughts on data and the role that plays and whether that's, you know, how critical that is to this, the questions that we're talking about today.
I'm not going to get into the specifics of who shot John in terms of what happened between Sony and Universal and Pandora in terms of requests for data and responses. I think that in looking at transparency, the reason it's so important in evaluating a potential benchmark for a competitive market rate is you have to look at what the alternatives are for a licensee. And I think that much of what's happened in the last couple of years in these cases, in the Pandora cases, is people tend to overlook the circumstances of digital services today. They built their business based on existing blanket licenses from ASCAP, BMI, and CSAC. So nobody had information. Pandora didn't negotiate for or get, and this is not unique to Pandora. It's true of every service. They didn't get information about who owns the compositions embedded in the sound recordings that are part of their service. They know what the sound recording name is and the artist, but they have no clue who owns the publishing rights, how fractured they are. And so you have a circumstance where when you flip the switch and the world changes and there are partial withdrawals, it's not just a question of how much is your catalog worth today looking forward. Too much money, I won't use your music anymore. That's not the circumstance we were in. We were in a circumstance where, absent doing a deal with Sony or doing a deal with Universal, Pandora would have had to take down all of Sony's and Universal's works. And how do you do that when you don't know what composition owners have the rights within the sound recordings embedded in your service? It's an impossible situation. Even going forward, if I started my service today, my ability to say no to Sony or no to Universal about doing a license without knowing who the actual rights owners are of the compositions and what sound recordings they're embedded in doesn't enable you to make a normal decision like you would in a sync license transaction, where before you put the music in the audiovisual work, you know what the music is, you choose to pay the rate or not. If the rate's too high, you say no, and you negotiate over a different work. That dynamic is fine. I love that direct licensing because it's a price competitive market. But when you shift it and you don't know, you're negotiating over the value of compositions embedded in sound recordings, you know the sound recordings, you don't know who owns what within the sound recording, you have a totally asymmetric situation from a bargaining perspective. And that's what Judge Coate felt was so important about rejecting the Sony and Universal benchmarks, because Pandora didn't have the equal ability to walk away and would have had to take all this content down to avoid infringing. In a going forward world, it's different, as long as we have transparency. And the transparency has to be so that, and this is part of the Department of Justice stuff that I know is one of the questions coming up, is the issue of, if you're going to allow partial withdrawals, the only content that would be eligible for withdrawal would be content where there's full transparency and notice to the licensee community. So you know well in advance of a deadline who owns what rights and what compositions and what sound recordings they're embodied in, and therefore you can avoid that imbalance that Judge Cote focused on.
Who wants to take it down at that end?
In a few words, the List argument was the reddest of red herrings in that case, as far as I'm concerned. There's evidence that Sony had information prior, 6 months prior, that there was going to be direct license negotiations coming up with Pandora. They'd done the deal with EMI. Pandora had done its deal with EMI without any List of works. At the time of the request that we got for the List of works, there were active negotiations. They were very close to making a deal, and there was never any indication. Look at the record in the trial. There was never any indication that there wouldn't be deals with Sony and subsequently with Universal. But as far as transparency is concerned, in many years of working for ASCAP, I can tell you that one of the first things a bar owner says when you try to license them is, tell us what your works are and we won't use them. Well, what are the works in the ASCAP repertory, or for that matter, the BMI repertory? You're talking about literally millions of copyrighted works. Sony's catalog alone, I'm sure, is in the hundreds of thousands, if not millions, of works. I don't know how quickly it could have been done to match the titles of the songs with the recording information that Pandora already had. But I can tell you that in the 17 or 16 days from the time we got the request until the time of the deal at the end of 2012? They never would have been able to complete the work necessary to take down all of Sony's works. And indeed, they didn't have any intent of taking down Sony's works. At least that's my belief. And subsequently, of course, they were able to do a deal with BMG after they took down BMG's works. So, again, as I say, a red herring.
I don't want to dwell on Pandora, but what Ken didn't tell you is that Pandora successfully removed another publisher's works from the service. So I don't think the question is, what didn't Pandora know about Sony? I think the question is, how did Pandora get rid of the other publisher? The answer is, they worked hard at it. They did what they should do. They did their research, and they successfully removed a publisher. So the thought that PRO data or even publisher data is what is standing between Pandora and an effective negotiation or competitive negotiation, I think, as Richard said, is a bit of a red herring. But let's turn away from Pandora just for a second. In terms of data, I think that everybody, the Copyright Office, the Senate, the user community, and the PROs recognize that we want to provide more, better data to the user community. And we're in favor of that, and that's part of BMI's proposal to the DOJ. That still raises certain questions. Who's going to pay for this? It's expensive. What's going to be included? The ISRCs are not a panacea. They are not the golden ticket to a competitive environment. ISRCs are decentralized. They are often inaccurate. They are often not there for older recordings. So the notion that we have to, as a musical works company, become the definitive repository for sound recording data, I think, again, is putting a burden on the PROs that, where it is not properly put. I would certainly think this is an industry problem. If it is a problem, it's an industry problem. It has to be an industry-wide solution. I would hope that Kenny's clients would be willing to turn over ISRC data they have for inclusion in the PRO databases if people are going to rely on them. But I think the point is, though, we recognize there's a need for data transparency. We're working towards that. We think we do a pretty good job today at it, but we're going to get better.
Okay, thank you. I think I have time for one more question to the panelists, which is sort of where are we in this, in the DOJ process, and what do you anticipate in terms of next steps, timing? I know whatever you can share, I'm sure people are curious to try and understand how this may unfold as we look down the road. And I'm going to start, since I've been starting with you a lot, Ken, I'm going to start at the other end of the table, and And then I want to make sure we have a few minutes for questions. I'm getting hand signals and paper signals over there.
I'll be quick. I think the DOJ has done a very thoughtful job in getting the viewpoints of not just the PROs, but everybody impacted in the community. And they've digested that. They've come back to us with a series of proposals. Part of it is a reaction to what the PROs ask for. Part of it is some suggestions on additional ways to improve the consent decree. In terms of just the nuts and bolts, where are we? We're in dialogue with them. We're going to be submitting some papers with our thoughts on this. I think the DOJ, without binding them, because they certainly haven't shared with me, I think
they don't like to be bound.
They don't. No, they don't. But nobody does. But the intention, I think, is in the next few weeks to a month to 2 months, I think, to absorb what the PROs have, and to see if we can land on an issue of agreement here where we can go in and make a joint motion to our respective rate courts for approval of the modifications to the decree.
Just to add very briefly, the word we're getting is that there will be another public comment period. It's up in the air at this point as to whether that will come before or after the proposed changes, assuming they're agreed upon between the department and ASCAP and BMI, are submitted to the respective judges.
I think it would be helpful to talk about the process. This is a unique process that the Department of Justice has adopted for this particular issue. They put out a request for public comments. Never before in any decree modification did they do that. A lot of people responded with public comments. There have been meetings between PROs and the Department of Justice and between services and the Department of Justice and industry organizations. The department came back and basically has told all of the stakeholders, we have some preliminary thoughts about what we might be willing to recommend. They've shared those preliminary thoughts about potential partial withdrawals, what kind of issues, what kind of conditions would be attached to partial withdrawals, et cetera, with everybody, and ask for private submissions to the staff. The staff will get those submissions, make a recommendation to the front office sometime probably within the next 60 days, and then the front office will make whatever decision it's going to make. If the front office and the PROs agree on an approach to modifying the decrees, they would have to make a motion to each of Judge Stanton and Judge Cote to request a modification of the decrees. I've lived through two of these decree modifications in 1994 and 2001. And what happens is the judges typically put out a notice so that everybody affected by the proposed decree modification would have an opportunity to put in written comments in response, and then the judges rule on the motion as to whether the burden has been carried as to whether the decree should be modified or not. So this process will not come to a conclusion until the earliest mid-next year. It's impossible to think otherwise.
Do you think that will lead to the Second Circuit's rule?
I've found this to be kind of odd that the Department of Justice wanted to go through this whole process when the Second Circuit might say Judge Cote and Judge Stanton were wrong. But the Department put in papers in the ASCAP appeal that basically said, we agree with Judge Cote, and we agree that partial withdrawals aren't appropriate under the BMI decree either.
But excuse me, but let's remember, though, that in her opinion, Judge Cote also said that the decree, if there are problems with it, should be fixed. So obviously the department has to address that concern.
Okay, so I think I'm going to open the floor to questions now. We had one okay, over there.
Yeah, Bill Rosenblatt from Giant Steps Media Technology Strategies. My question is about the metadata thing. Have there been any substantive arguments against having an authoritative rights database other than my organization, fill in the blank here, doesn't want to pay for it?
Well, if you're talking about one organization doing it, I don't know of one that's capable of doing it. Now, there have been a number of industry initiatives to try to collect as much data as possible, but it's a tremendous task. People sometimes think that, the songwriter and the publisher and that's the end of it. But today, particularly in an era of sampling, you might have 10 writers and 10 publishers, or 15 and 15, or 15 and 20. So there's an awful lot of data out there to be collected. I might mention that We have recently, on our website, the ASCAP website, made available to anyone the ability to download entire publisher or writer catalogs, and indeed the entire ASCAP catalog. But you better have the right software to do it.
Okay. Next.
Hi, I'm Mark Jacobson. I've heard talk about if there is a withdrawal. This is one of the questions you asked, but I don't think there was a follow-up on it. If there was a withdrawal by the major publishers, and in fact, when they withdraw the works, they would then give them back to ASCAP and BMI to administer at a lower rate, a lower cost.
Yeah, so the question, I forgot to repeat the last one, which was obviously about metadata, but this one is, the question is, if publishers do withdraw their rights, and I think in all or in part, could they still have ASCAP or BMI administer them? And if so, might that be at a lower rate than the current commission rate?
I can start with the answer here. I think it's first important to make a distinction between with partially withdrawing publishers and terminating publishers, at least from BMI's perspective. If you are a partially withdrawing publisher, you remain a BMI affiliate, you're a customer, you're a client of ours, and we want to be able to service you. And so, yeah, we would be interested in, and we are, in fact, doing some administration for certain direct deals. If you are terminated from BMI, I think we'd have to take a separate look as to whether we'd be interested in providing services for a competing publisher. In terms of the rate, this is the way the administration would work is we are handed a bag of money and it's run through our pipes. So whatever deals are made by the publishers directly, we would effectuate. But that is different from, there's not an attempt, generally speaking, to harmonize the rates or the fees associated with admin.
Let me briefly speak to that. There's a real problem even with partial withdrawals and having ASCAP and BMI administer, because the concept there is the withdrawing publisher is going to be competing with ASCAP and BMI, arguably, for the sale of performing rights in that marketplace. And if you allow the withdrawing publisher information to be freely available to ASCAP and BMI, then you have much more concern about price fixing, or at least coordination, where a competitor who ordinarily would not have access to what the other competitor's deal is now has access to it. And that's one of the reasons the Department of Justice, in terms of its initial thoughts, has asked for responses from the PROs and from the digital services as to whether ASCAP and BMI ought to be permitted to do the administration for withdrawing publishers. Should the department ultimately support withdrawing partial withdrawals?
That's not my understanding. My understanding is that the department would support the idea of PROs doing admin as long as there were sufficient protections in place. And I might add that long before the DOJ served its first notice requesting public comment on decree reform, one of our first conversations with the DOJ highlighted the potential for a problem and the fact that BMI would build all necessary firewalls to assure that the withdrawn publishers did not have a single advantage.
Okay. Yes, Barry.
Yeah. Has anyone thought about what would happen if one of the rate court judges approves a DOJ right?
Yes. Yes.
Okay. So
what have you thought?
I just want to repeat the question. No, it's my duty here. Has anyone considered whether what would happen if one rate court judge says yes to partial withdrawal and modification, and the other one says no?
Well, to me, it's one step at a time. You see how all of this plays out and what the recommendations are. I suppose in that instance, we could all fall back on the notion that if all isn't agreed, then nothing is agreed. So there's that possibility, I'm sure.
Okay. There's always the Second Circuit, too, right? Wouldn't that, mightn't they sort of figure it out?
I'll tell you that after I see their decision in Pandora.
Okay. All right, fair enough, yes.
Isn't that just a split in the circuits?
Okay, I think that was a comment, a rhetorical question. I think we have time for one more question out there. That's it? You've heard everything you need to know? Okay. Yes?
I'm just curious why the licensees always mention this problem with transparency in catalogs, because you can see all of the publishers that own all the songs on BMI and ASCAP's website. If you go there, it's not like they're hiding, they're not telling you which or who they are.
Okay,
it's not searchable. It's not available, or until the recent ASCAP changes, you couldn't get all of the works of a given publisher upon going there. You'd have to go work by work, and you'd have to know which composition is by exact name you were searching for. It was totally unworkable, and that's the reason why, and the point is, and we talked about ISRCs a little bit, or Stuart did, without knowing what sound recordings the compositions are embodied in, when you're dealing with a digital audio service, the fact that you can get one by one, you can put in the name, you know, I Love You, into the database. ASCAP will tell you how many songs it controls with that name, who owns them, but it doesn't always tell you what sound recording it's embodied in by what performing artist. So in order to have a basis upon which to have a searchable, scalable database showing the sound recordings and the corresponding compositions, that's something that is not available today. And that's something that the digital audio services really need in order for them to effectively choose whether they're going to do a license with publisher X or not in a world of withdrawal. Because if they need that information in order to steer away from the compositions embodied in sound recordings that they don't get licenses to.
Let me just add this, and it goes back to Ken's original point about the irony in all of this. Here, to me, is the ultimate irony. For years and years, we've heard people say, we don't want to pay for the blanket license because we don't use all the works. We only use a small number. Yet now you're talking about a Pandora and a Spotify. They literally need the right to millions of compositions because that's what their customers want. You'd think that if no one else was willing to pay a fair market price for a blanket license, it would be people like Pandora.
And we are.
Thank you.
And we are.
All right. On that note, I want to thank our panelists and the Copyright Society. Very informative. We heard it. You heard it from the experts up here today.
And before we go, let me just say about Jacqueline and this panel. I've been on a lot of panels all over the country. I've never seen anyone who is moderating a panel prepare her panelists as well as Jacqueline did for us.